When the worship committee asked me to do this morning, I assume they know me well enough to know what they were going to get into, that it wouldn't be mush, but it would probably be kind of serious. In my annual search for just the right Valentine for Kathy, now 54 of them, I went through the emotions I often feel when searching through the variety. Funny cards, a little cynical, saccharine, sensitive, romantic, very romantic, over-the-top romantic. Why don't people just write what they mean and skip the prepackaged sentiment? I've said this to myself many times, and I've tried it on numerous occasions. Writing exactly what you feel and mean is not easy. I've struggled to express what is both delicate and complex. These efforts have taught me to appreciate those Hallmark cards. Somehow in their abundance, they capture nuances and expressions that, looking carefully, can say more and better things than I can say. And yet they say what I mean. So this year I looked for just the right card, and of course I found it. This is romantic love, the dynamic balance between attraction, including erotic attraction, appreciation, caring, duty, dependence, and a myriad other things. We experience other kinds of love, or at least of things we call love. So, what is love? Looking at different languages to see how they conceptualize love is fascinating. Many languages use different words for broadly different kinds of love, whereas English tends to have only one, love. Each language slices and dices love in its own way, and these vary from language to language quite a bit, but there are certain commonalities: erotic love, attraction, mutual dependence, appreciation, lust, embracing all people, embracing God, the world, or something mysterious and divine, and so on. But all this leaves love as an idea pretty vague. Are we talking about different things that we just happen to use one word for? Or is it one thing that manifests in different ways, like electricity and magnetism being one thing, a single force? Perhaps the sciences can help. Biologists have argued that the experience of love is a spectrum that changes over time, beginning with lust, followed by attraction, and eventually attachment. Other biologists hold that attachment is based on commitments, including marriage, children, or friendship rooted in shared interests. These various degrees of relationship release chemicals that affect the brain: oxytocin, vasopressin, nerve growth factor proteins, and so on. Am I attached to another because of chemicals? Psychologists see love as a cognitive and social phenomenon involving intimacy, commitment, and passion. Passionate sexual desires promote mating, and those chemicals again, increases in testosterone and estrogen. Attachment is associated with commitment, and falling in love releases neurotransmitter hormones, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, producing side effects similar to those produced by amphetamines. Psychological research suggests that these effects last anywhere from 1.5 to 3 years. So attachment is critical to long-term relationships. Evolutionary psychologists are a hard-headed bunch. They see love as a survival tool. On the one hand, it provides parental support to offspring that are parent-dependent for a longer period than with most animals. And it helps reproduction in that bonding reduces the chances of sexually transmitted diseases, which are increased by promiscuity. So biology and psychology both find that sexual attraction and attachment are fundamental components of love. What is lacking here is obvious. The focus is on interpersonal relationships, mates and mating. But what about love of humanity, of the earth, of all living things, and for many people, an intense love of God? Where is the vasopressin and oxytocin in these? Somehow I don't find these approaches definitive. While I don't doubt that attraction releases chemicals or that love supports species survival, these are not enough to explain the experience of love. When I love someone, I'm not thinking of chemicals or survival. I'm thinking of that person. We need a deeper understanding of love that is more than various mechanisms that are associated with it. Faith traditions have plumbed love more deeply and broadly than biology, psychology, and neuroscience have typically done. Besides the message of love in Christianity, which blends love of our fellow human beings and love of God, ideas such as loving kindness have played a major part in Christian belief and action. Buddhists have linked insight and compassion, prajna and karuna, so that one's understanding of self and others leads naturally to loving sympathy toward all. Hindu philosophy has wrestled with the question of love for at least 5,000 years. Without the science we have, without understanding the biology of the brain, without psychology as we know it, Hindus saw the necessity of finding some ground that gives rise to all forms of love we actually experience. Sanskrit, the ancient language of Hindu thought, has six words for love. There is kama, which means love in the sense of desire. It is erotic. Metta has to do with friendliness, with being friends, and so on. More than any other ancient tradition of thought, Hindu thinking reveled in nuance and shading of everything complex. In the oldest hymns in history, the Rig Veda, 10 cycles of poems to various gods, we find what we call the hymn to creation. It begins with the declaration that there is neither being nor non-being in the beginning. Ultimate origins are beyond categories and conceptions, even such basic ones as existence and non-existence. And then it declares that kama first arose in it. Kama can be translated accurately as desire, love, or eros. It is distinctly an erotic desire. From this, everything in heaven and on earth emerged. In this view, the erotic impulse pervades all existence. For the philosophical Hindu, this primordial force, which existed before anything existed that could embody or experience it, underpins evolution and psychology. This view confirms that love is an activity, not just a feeling, as psychologist Scott Peck said. There is more, for kama manifests in myriad ways. In nature, it manifests as the evolution of the universe and the origin of worlds. In living kingdoms, it manifests as species communities and as reproduction and nurturing the young. In human beings, it manifests in the most complex ways. The word exist comes from the Latin stare, to stand, and ex, out from. For anything to exist, it must stand out from something else, a background. Kama is both background and foreground, underlying the very possibility of existence. Its most fundamental expression is as karma and dharma. Karma, many people understand, is a principle of cause and effect in the sense that every action has an opposite and equal reaction. But for the Hindu, this principle applies across the board. It is a physical law, and it is a psycho-spiritual law, governing thought, emotion, feeling, and action. What goes around comes around, you may have heard. Dharma can be translated as law, truth, teaching, duty, and the way things are and ought to be. The laws of nature are physical dharma. The psychological structure of the human being is psychological dharma, law, duty, truth, and teaching all in one. In this view, the erotic force is not just sexual desire, which is only one manifestation of Eros. It is the underlying principle of creation or evolution, pervading everything all the time. In this view, love is the unifying force of existence. But force is force. The force of speech can heal or harm. The nuclear force can power spaceships and poison the earth. Tidal force refreshes oceans and wreaks havoc on ships and shorelines. The force of gravity holds us to earth and causes us to fall when we stumble. Both Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader draw on the force. So like all forces, the force of love must be used wisely and carefully. And this too is Dharma, one manifestation of Eros. So love as an activity requires understanding. We often hear that you can't love another if you don't love yourself. Surely this is true, for if I dislike myself, it's hard to like others, because another who comes close is always in part a mirror in which I am reflected. This is why psychologists tell us that we often project onto others what we find and dislike in ourselves. But if loving myself allows me to love others, it can also become negative and destructive. Remember Narcissus? The beautiful boy who saw his reflection in a pond and was so struck by it and engrossed in it that he could not look away, eventually starving to death, or in some versions, drowning. Narcissism is one negative possibility. Obsession is another. A desperate attempt to fill the missing elements in myself by seizing them in another. This is why we worry about low self-esteem. It does not seem possible to supply it from outside its victim. Though we may have ways of helping one suffering from this condition to learn to eliminate it over time. When we support one another, we are helping each other to release our full selves, to love ourselves in ways that allow us to love others. Seeing love is not only a feeling but is an activity, we can better understand not just romantic love, but also love between friends. Because of the way we slice and dice the idea of love in our culture, we have tended to categorize relationships in rather frozen terms. So we might be embarrassed to think of friendship in terms of Eros. Clearly Walt Whitman was not, nor are individuals in many cultures, past and present. Perhaps we think of love a little too exclusively in sexual terms, which is only one, though an important one, expression of Eros. We can loosen our cultural and linguistic categories and tighten our thinking about love and relationships. When I say I love someone, what do I mean? Clearly, some kind of attraction is involved, some kind of warmth in this person's presence. There is delight in being around this person, most of the time. There is commitment, for when the relationship is strained, I stick to it, intending to move past the strain. There is concern for this person, at least sometimes putting their interests ahead of my own. There is willingness to be a listener, to be sympathetic, to sometimes say the hard thing that needs to be said, and sometimes to be indulgent. And the success of all this depends on some degree of self-understanding. I need to know my motives. Am I giving or trying to get? Am I aiming to enrich our lives or to suck something out of you? What am I up to? What do I want? What do I want to be? What do I want for you? And this, the Hindu philosophers say, are manifestations of one fundamental force. And as we reach for self-understanding, which then allows us to understand others better, love also reaches beyond these important one-to-one relationships. We love circles of people, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, nephews, aunts, uncles, and so on. But we also love communities, such as our beloved community of Booth, right here. Why? Again, the questions arise. Am I giving or trying to get? Am I aiming to enrich our lives together? What am I up to? What do I want? The answers will be different from those in romantic love and even those in family love. But there are answers. They will not be quite the same for each of us, but that doesn't matter. There is an eros in community that we all participate and share. There is something electric or magnetic in community. And then there is existence as a whole, as expressed in our seventh principle, respect for all existence. We each are part of humanity, and Dharma teaches us that, being embedded in humanity, there are duties and truths and laws of being a part of it. The questions arise again. And we are a part of the whole universe, a seemingly infinitesimal part, but a conscious part, and that is all important. The questions can be asked yet again. In the Hindu view, not listening to Dharma, our duty to the whole, our truth in the whole, results in negative karma, which is also eros, is cause and effect. Physically, socially, morally, and spiritually, we are interconnected whether we realize it or not, or whether we pay attention to it or not. But recognizing that interconnection is what makes us distinctly human. When the calamity of time affects one limb, Saadi said, the other limbs cannot remain at rest. So we embody and express eros, the kama that first arose in it. Love pervades everything we are or do, whether positive or negative, and it is our awareness, vulnerability, and intention that makes its expression positive. Psychologists see love as healthy and binding, though they are aware of its negative possibilities. Evolutionary theorists hold that love is part of natural selection, a trait that helps us survive. Theologians say it is a gift from God. The Hindu philosopher says it is the fundamental force which creates, sustains, and evolves the universe and is present and active in everything and everywhere. We can accept the more restricted psychological and evolutionary views, but much remains. I prefer the Hindu view for the simple, almost scientific reason that it better explains all the phenomena of love. Some say love is an inexplicable mystery and that some experienced forms of love are like mystical experiences. I can accept this too. Love as fundamental cannot be explained by what it gives rise to. It is deeper than any particular manifestation of it, any particular experience of it. We might have wondered from time to time why love, which is emphasized in the phrase beloved community, is not mentioned in our seven principles. But now we can see why. Love suffuses all seven principles. Without love, they would be mere echoes of some dead philosophy. Like the alchemical elixir that turns lead into gold, love brings the principles to life. Through love, they awaken and encourage the better angels of our nature. Love is like a fingerprint. The lines of fingerprints fall into broad categories, but each fingerprint is unique. That's why they can be used for identification. Love is like that, never quite the same in each experience. There's a mystery here that cannot be captured in simplistic categories like romantic love, friendship, beloved community, love of God. When we see these categories as general and imprecise, we cease to be rigid in our understanding and can open ourselves to a richer experience of love. In that vulnerable openness, love of another, love of family, beloved community, love of humanity, and of all existence are experienced as manifestations of the underlying mystery. May we each receive, nurture, and sustain our fingerprints of the mystery that is love.